Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've traveled over half our state to be here tonight. I couldn't get away sooner because my new well was coming in at Coyote Hills and I had to see about it. Ladies and gentlemen, if I say I'm an oil man, you will agree. I'm a family man. I run a family business. This is my son and my partner, H.W. Plainview.
You boys are a regular family business.
Now, you have a great chance here.
My son is a healer and a vessel for the Holy Spirit. He has a church.
You will be cast up and thrust back to perdition.
I'm fixed like no other company in this field. I have a string of tools ready to put to work. That's why I can guarantee to start drilling and to put up the cash to back my word. I assure you, ladies and gentlemen, no matter what the others promise to do, when it comes to the showdown, they won't be there.
There's a whole ocean of oil under our feet. No one can get at it except for me.
We'll offer $150,000 for full title.
When do we get our money, Daniel?
I look at people and I see nothing worth liking.
Don't bully me, Daniel, please!
I see the worst in people.
We have a sinner with us.
Get out of here, devil!
I have a competition in me. I want no one else to succeed. I can't keep doing this on my own. With these, people.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Rob St. Mary, and joining me, of course, co-host, Mr. Mike White.
I brought a very long straw with me tonight.
Well, you're going to need it. And joining us is special guest co-host, film critic from the Detroit Metro Times, Mr. Jeff Myers.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's good being on the bloodletting, so to speak.
All right. This week, we're talking about the 2007 film There Will Be Blood, based on the 1927 novel Oil by Upton St. Clair. The Paul Thomas Anderson film tells the tale of a wildcat prospector in California around the turn of the 20th century. Daniel Day-Lewis plays Daniel Plainview, a man driven by the need to win at all costs in the oil game. And with him is his son, H.W., but the elder oil man uses deception, sometimes religion, when he feels it's valuable to him, and menace to get what he wants. A pipeline to the Pacific Ocean in order to move the oil from under the lands that he is either bought or leased. The film also stars Paul Dano as twin brothers Paul and Eli Sunday, the latter being a man of God who sees the appearance of Daniel Plainview, his money, and the oil as a method to move his charismatic Christianity forward. There Will Be Blood is an epic film in the greatest sense of the word. It's a film that explores America's battles between business and religion, how both work together at times, and the victims of those who are often left in the wake of the greedy hands of both, including the individuals at the levers of industry. Also, just a warning, as we're getting into the film, we are going to talk about the end of the film. So if you haven't seen There Will Be Blood and you don't want it spoiled for you, just go ahead and turn off the podcast. Go watch the film and come back, because we'll be waiting for you. Now, Jeff, as our guest, tell us your thoughts, you know, small overview on the film, and maybe if you've read the book, if you had a chance to read it.
Well, actually, I haven't read the book, so I can't speak to that directly, but I have read some of Sinclair's work, and it's pretty clear to me that Thomas's film isn't exactly a slavish interpretation of the man's style narratively or thematically. but probably more of a jumping off point. It's funny. I think the movie has its flaws, but I actually think it's fair to say that Anderson's, his fifth movie, is as close to a Citizen Kane for the new millennium as we've gotten so far. Of course, we're only 13 years into the new millennium, so there are a few other directors that might jump in. But what I think is, what's obvious is that both films tackle the myth of the American dream or the self-made man and how that dovetails with both men's God complex, from its, wordless 15 minutes to the final violent end, where it, of course, delivers, the promise of its title. I really do agree with you. It's a very bold and beautiful movie that encapsulates some distinctly American values.
As for you, Mr. White?
Well, this was the first time that I saw There Will Be Blood. I kept hearing how great it was, but yet I still was very hesitant. I'm not a big fan of Paul Thomas Anderson, and I've really tried to like his stuff. I've watched, I think, just about everything now that he's done, other than maybe Hard Eight. And I kind of had the same criticism with this one that I had with The Master that we talked about back on our Battlefield Earth or Makapamu episode, where it felt like, and even though this was adapted from a book, it felt like it was there was a larger narrative that was going on that the director didn't feel like he had to share with us. So I constantly kept questioning, why is this character doing what he's doing? And I never really got very satisfactory answers to it.
Do you like Paul Thomas Anderson better than his brother Wes?
Oh, my God. I don't know of a filmmaker that I like less than Wes, but I don't like P.T. too much more. I definitely like his other brother, Paul W.S. Anderson, a lot more.
Oh, God, please.
I will watch Event Horizon any day of the week over Punch Drunk Love.
And The Three Musketeers?
Sure, why not?
or any of the Resident Evil movies?
Any of them, yes.
Oh, boy. My heart hurts.
I just had to throw that in there because I know you're such a big fan of Wes Anderson.
I think Mike's observation is not, it doesn't surprise me, particularly with There Will Be Blood. I could probably, we could probably get into it with his earlier films, but I do think with There Will Be Blood, there is a somewhat of a shift in Anderson's work, which is that there is a remove that he continued even further in The Master, where he doesn't exactly invite you into the narrative anymore, which I would argue that he very much does in Magnolia and Boogie Nights and Punch Drunk Love. But when you get to this movie, for lack of a better word, there's a little bit of show-offiness about his style. And I think he's less concerned with inviting the audience to go on this journey.
And we'll get into that later in the episode, because I wanted to kind of talk about how this fits into his other films, thematically, and also, as you were talking sure. about, sort of how he works with it. So what Anderson really is giving us is sort of turn of the century, the oil boom, the rise of the robber barons to some extent. But this guy is obviously a very minor player in this era of Rockefeller and Standard Oil and trusts and all of that stuff. The movie's plot focuses between basically 1890 and the 1920s, right before the stock market crash. And as talked about in the opening, Daniel Plainview, when we first meet him, is trying to scrape out a living, literally, out of the ground. And by the end, is become a wealthy man.
He almost sounds like Gollum in the beginning with his "yes, there you are."
Yeah, exactly. And all of this sort of plays in the background, as he said, this whole thing with the oil boom being the place where we meet this character. And what I thought would be interesting is to talk a little bit about the book Oil by Upton St. Clair. And in interviews, Paul Thomas Anderson said he only used about the first 150 pages of the book, obviously changed the character names quite a bit, the main focus basically being this father-son relationship. And the one thing that is really diminished from a conversation you'll hear in a bit with Professor Kevin Mattson is Upton St. Clair really wanted to bring America in the 20s and even a little bit before into the idea of socialism and getting them to accept this idea of, you know, maybe it's okay for the government to own things, because obviously robber barons, which he had seen, you know, in the decades before, had been basically running amok over people. So you haven't read the book, Jeff. I haven't read the book, but Mike worked on it a little bit. So I thought I would ask Mike as to what he thought so far.
So far, I'm loving it. It is a terrific book, really well written. And there are a lot of parts that are lifted directly from the book that find their way into the movie. The first bit of dialogue that we hear, and I love that opening. I do have to say, the opening, 15, 20 minutes, that's pretty much completely silent, no dialogue going on. And then we start with Plainview giving this speech to a bunch of people that are buying leases for this oil property. And having listened to the book, I think I'm to the eighth section. There are 21 sections of the book. And listening to that, I am gleaning a lot more about the characters that I got from Anderson's film, kind of watching it cold first. And so it's given me a little bit more. But it's funny how much more the book focuses on the son, whose name is J. Arnold Ross Jr. in the book, though everybody just calls him Bunny. So if I happen to call H.W. Bunny while we're recording this episode, please forgive me. I'm always wondering, though, H.W., if that's like a Herbert Walker Bush kind of reference. What do you guys think?
Sounds interesting. Could be a possibility, considering this came out during the Bush era.
And you do have the connection of oil.
Right. It's funny, there is a lot more family going on inside of the book. Really, Bunny has a whole extended family. The mother is still present. It's not this whole idea of being abandoned and taken in by Daniel Plainview. You get this whole thing of the mother is kind of removed from the family, but she's still there. And there's an aunt and an older sister. And then, the father and son relationship itself. And you even get more of the Sunday family. Rob, I believe you mentioned Eli Sunday, the charismatic preacher, and Paul Sunday, who's in one scene in the movie, is pretty much throughout the entire book and plays a very important role in Bunny's upbringing, and kind of is always this character that he looks to for guidance. He kind of is looking at his father and at Paul Sunday at the same time, and kind of, you know, using them both as his moral compass throughout. And it's nice to see the way that he compares the two. So he's removed, Paul is removed, and then Eli's kind of in his place a little bit. And though you don't really get a connection between H.W. and Eli at all in the movie, it's more how Daniel and Eli kind of play about. And the whole idea of H.W. losing his hearing is not there at all. So that, like, pretty much right around the time that the oil starts coming out of the ground, that's when the shift happens, and that's when you move completely away from the book and into movie realm.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, before we get too far in, I called up Professor Kevin Mattson. He's a professor at Ohio University, and he wrote a book called Upton Sinclair and the Other American Century. And I thought that he could give us some understanding of who Upton Sinclair was and what led to the writing of Oil, which was the basis for There Will Be Blood.
So my name is Kevin Mattson. I'm the Connor Studdy Professor of Contemporary History at Ohio University, and I teach classes in contemporary American history, and particularly in cultural and political history.
So you've written several books. Why a book about Upton Sinclair?
Well, at that point in time, not much had been done on him. He actually got two biographies that came out at the same exact moment, because Anthony Arthur had written one. We didn't know that we were writing simultaneously on Sinclair. I was really interested in Sinclair because I'm really interested in the history of American radicalism, interested in what socialism once meant in the past, which is, I think, a term that today has become completely misused. We don't really understand what socialism meant. So I wanted to explore that kind of those broad ideas and questions, and using Sinclair's life, which was a long life, was helpful because I could also write kind of not just a biography, but a kind of attempt at a history of American radicalism through the eyes of this one particular person.
So talking about him as a person, and about sort of that radicalism, kind of put me in the times that he was around and what kind of things he was dealing with.
Sure. So the accomplishment that he's most known for, and that I think everybody would recognize his name by, is the publication of The Jungle, which comes out in 1906. And it's actually a good place to start because he's in his young adult years when he writes the book. And it's also the book that gets him incredible public recognition. And it's also a book where he's trying, as he puts it, to write a kind of Uncle Tom's Cabin sort of novel, but about the industrial working class and the exploitation they're undergoing. And to write this novel, he feels that he has to understand the industry that he's going to write about, which is the meatpacking plants in and around Chicago. And he does a lot of research, actually goes and observes the work process for people in the meatpacking plants, takes down a bunch of notes, and then writes up this sort of fictional account, which tells the story of an immigrant who comes to America and to Chicago, and then undergoes sort of all sorts of horrible forms of industrial exploitation, falls into alcoholism, his wife gets pregnant, dies by the second childbirth, the sanitary conditions are horrific, and in this novel, Sinclair also writes about how sausage is made, how meat is actually packed, and he exposes the fact that rats and poison and men's urine and maybe even human bodies are being dumped into these vats that are then making the meat that's going onto Americans' breakfast tables. And so the novel becomes the sensation because it's seen as this sort of expose of the meatpacking industry. A lot of people knew about it before, but this book kind of, you know, is this thing that people can grab onto and say, oh my God, if what he's saying is real, this is a major problem for Americans to deal with. And so he puts this book out there in hopes that Americans will react to the exploitation of the industrial working class. What they really react to are the grotesque descriptions of the way the meat is made. And you actually get legislation that some people say has something to do with the publication of The Jungle in 1906, which is legislation that Teddy Roosevelt, the president at the time, is eager to promote, which is the Meat Inspection Act, which gives federal government oversight over the way the meat is made. And what's interesting about this novel is it's what propels Upton Sinclair to fame as one of probably the most famous socialist at the time. It also is deeply disappointing for Sinclair because what Sinclair really wanted to do was to institute socialism in America. He wanted the government to, in fact, just take over the meatpacking plants and to produce in the public interest. So he sees this as this amazing push into publicity, uses the publicity to try to publicize the idea of socialism, but in many ways, he also feels he kind of fails because his ideas never really entirely get through in the way he wants them to. And then from that point on, he lives, into the 1960s, and he constantly comes back to this question of how can I get socialist ideas across to the American people in the most effective manner. One of the things that he does in the 1930s is that he will run for governor of California, and he will try to kind of take his radical socialist ideas and meld them into a kind of New Deal Democratic Party sort of message, and runs for governor and is defeated in large part because of a huge publicity campaign that's pulled against him. But in every single episode of his life, he's constantly trying to figure out ways that he can get what he thinks are kind of socialist ideas across to the widest audience possible.
You said that from your feeling and your reading on his term of the use of socialism and sort of the modern use of it today, that there's a little bit of a difference. Can you explain what that might be?
Yeah, I mean, I think the term now is just a political buzzword that's used by predominantly right-wing people, and they'll stain almost anything that where, you know, government gets involved, they'll stain that as socialism. So, you know, Obamacare becomes socialism, when in fact it's really not. I mean, nobody's actually socializing our healthcare system. That is having the government entirely take it over and try to run it on the public interest model. That's what Sinclair meant, was that, you know, in fact, the industries like the meatpacking industry should be taken over by the government. Workers should have the right to democratic self-management of these industries, but that all production should be for use by people, not to make a profit, but to put things on, you know, onto a useful, productive set of values and a public interest that would allow for wealth to be, you know, much more equally distributed. So today, I think it's become this kind of silly buzzword that people use to shout down any attempt to have the government do something to create more equity. I think in Sinclair's time, it actually meant what I think it's supposed to mean, which is the actual management of private industry by the government for the public interest.
I contacted you because we're doing on the episode There Will Be Blood, which is based on his book Oil, and was wondering if you could give me a little bit of background on that book, its creation and release.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, Sinclair had been active for quite some time before he actually publishes Oil. So, you know, I mean, The Jungle is, I think, where he gets the most amount of fame from. And Oil is published, you know, quite literally like 20 years after The Jungle. So it's a book of the 1920s. He went into a kind of despair, the way a lot of American radicals did after the period of time that he publishes The Jungle. And one of the reasons for this is that he is one of the key supporters for America's entry into World War I. He's coming at it from a socialist angle. He believes that the sort of German autocratic state needs to be kind of, you know, overthrown. He believes that in the wake of that, there will be some sort of socialist revolution in Germany. And as he watches the way World War I actually progresses, he gets very, very deeply disillusioned by his original support of the war. And so that by the 1920s, after the war has passed and after his support of it is then called into question by himself, he enters the 1920s, which is, of course, a decade that usually it's studied as the kind of the high watermark of American conservatism. After all the reforms, including things like the Meat Inspection Act of the pre-war years, you start seeing a kind of return to conservative, laissez-faire economics on the part of three Republican presidents. So you have Harding, you have Coolidge, and you have Hoover at the end of the 1920s. And he's recoiling from the kind of conservative drift of America. And he's trying to figure out ways to kind of, again, convey his socialist message as best as he can. And he's still convinced that the best way to do this isn't by, you know, actually engaging in politics necessarily, but it's to write a novel. And that becomes the basis of Oil. One of the biggest scandals of the 1920s was the Teapot Dome scandal, where it was seen that the Department of the Interior, the Secretary of the Interior, was taking kickback money by selling public lands to private oil interest. And so he's deeply disgraced by this, and he sees it as kind of emblematic of what's wrong in American politics and what's wrong with corruption. And so he tries to find a way to write a novel that can get at that kind of theme. And one of the things that he recognizes is that he's living in the Los Angeles area. His wife is actually managing, for the most part, a lot of their money, and she's actually being approached by oil men who want to drill in the area to sell her property. And he actually goes to a number of meetings where he sees these oil men saying, "Look, you've got oil on your property. We want to get at it. You should sell us your land and sell to us fast, because, you know, someone else is going to come along and steal it." And he witnesses, he sees these events as this kind of the true representation of American greed, and then decides to kind of concoct this novel that in some ways is like The Jungle was, about his own observations about what's going on with an oil boom in Los Angeles during the 1920s and nationwide. There's an oil boom going on. Tries to write a novel about that historical event, but tells it with a kind of a storyline that people can follow and learn the lessons he wants them to learn, but in something of an entertaining way. My sense of Oil is that it's actually one of his best novels, because he spends a lot of time at developing the characters that he talks about. And it's one of those novels, though it has a political message, it's not a case where the political message drowns out the novel itself. If you read The Jungle, you get a sense that all Sinclair wants to do is to expose industrial exploitation. So he makes his central character go through just this train of miserable events where you feel pounded on the head about the message he's trying to get out. What you get in Oil is a little bit more complexity, a lot more richness of the characters, and I think a story that's entertaining and yet also still winds up carrying a kind of socialist message to it. And by the way, that is totally dropped out in the film version of the book.
You said it's about 20 years between The Jungle and Oil. Do you think that's just by virtue of him becoming a better writer and understanding how to write?
No, it's unfortunately the reverse, in fact, because what Sinclair does is that he had been a struggling author up through The Jungle. He had written a number of books, a number of novels, not like The Jungle before. He had also written a lot of potboilers for like popular magazines, sometimes not using his own, using a pen name. He was writing a lot. He wrote, in fact, I think he's a kind of author who wrote a little bit too much. And what happens when The Jungle gets published in 1906 is he just takes all of these novels that he couldn't get published before and sends them off to publishers who are keen to, publish him, because now he's got the fame and the stature and the celebrity status. And so, he pumps out a lot of bad stuff, a lot of poorly written, poorly constructed novels that just aren't, I think, books that we still read today the way we'd still read The Jungle and perhaps somewhat still read Oil. So he's had this kind of string of bad novels, not really highly respected novels. He's done a lot of experimentation in his life with diets. He's divorced his first wife. His life is kind of not at the height of its, it's not what Sinclair wants to be. And I think Oil is this novel where he says, look, I got to sit down and take some time and really write a well-developed novel. So no, there's a lot of stuff that falls between, a lot of publications that fall between The Jungle and Oil. But I think Oil is that novel that a lot of people read and say, oh, it really does seem to be that he's putting a lot of effort and a lot of time into the actual narration of a story.
And when it comes out, what was the reaction?
There wasn't much of a reaction to it. It's not a book that seized the conscience of America. It's certainly nowhere came close to The Jungle. I mean, The Jungle is being discussed everywhere. When the President of the United States is talking about a novel, the way Obama talked about Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, that something's going on. The novel is getting attention. That doesn't happen with Oil. But what does happen with Oil is that as it comes out, there are parts of the book that some people find to be lewd, we would say, references to sex, some references to nudity, and things like that. And it actually is banned in Boston. And Sinclair tries to use this banning in Boston as not just to attack censorship of literary works, which was pretty prevalent during this period of time in American history, but also tries to use it to, as you can imagine, gain some recognition for his novel, tries to use it as a kind of publicity stunt to a certain extent. So he goes to Boston and sells copies of the novel with fig leaves on the sections that have been deemed to be inappropriate or obscene, with the hope that this will publicize not just the fight against censorship, which he firmly believes in, but also this will get his novel more attention. The reason for that is simply because the novel at the time of its publication is just not, it doesn't get much recognition. I think it's mostly people who go back to Sinclair's work. They realize there's a lot of it. You have to read, there's a famous picture of Sinclair where he's standing next to his publications and they literally, go above his head and stand higher than he is. And he wrote a lot. He wrote very quickly. He wrote in a kind of, with the intention of conveying a political message, and he kind of became a writing machine. But when people go back to his publications, I think most people say you can find some publications that are actually quite good and stand on their own. And I think Oil's one of them. It's certainly the novel that he's most known for publishing during the 1920s.
It's funny, when we were chatting by email before the conversation, you said that the differences between Oil and There Will Be Blood reminded you of a section of your own life when you were supposed to do a test on Catch-22.
Yeah, Yeah, that's right. So I was a young high school student, and the teacher, I had a great English teacher who assigned both Joseph Heller and Kurt Vonnegut to us, and he assigned Catch 22, and then we were supposed to take an exam on the book. And so a midnight movie cinema was showing the film version of Catch 22, which, if you've ever seen it, it just condenses, it takes whole characters and it just condenses them into like one character. So when you're watching it, you're thinking to yourself, wait a second, that doesn't happen to that character, that happens to another character. And but you're realizing, oh no, he's actually, you know, compacting this very long novel in this sort of super tight way so it can fit the movie. And it messed with my head. I remember thinking, oh my Lord, I'm going to have to go back and reread the book again to try to sort out what I remember about it. I think I wound up doing okay on the exam in the end, but it is the novel, you know, when people turn, I mean, you know this because this is what you guys look at a lot of the time. Turning a novel into a movie is not easy. And, you know, I think like the reaction, for instance, to, you know, how many times has The Great Gatsby been made and usually not taken to be a very good filmmaking of the novel. It's a tough thing to do. And this is a case where the director of this film and the screenwriters obviously just condensed a lot and took out some of the chief messages that the book actually holds in it.
There Will Be Blood, to me, sort of seems to be, at its core, the Paul Thomas Anderson film seems to be about two ideas. And I would say it's like American greed and corporate business and American religiosity.
Yeah.
And sometimes they fight against each other and sometimes they work together.
That's
and
right.
When you look at the differences between oil and the film, what do you see as, you know, what's there between what Sinclair wrote and what isn't there in terms of what Sinclair wrote?
Yeah, and you know, I mean, you're right. That is, I mean, I think in some ways Sinclair would be happy if, but with the two themes that you just pointed out, if those are central to the film, they are central to the novel. Here's what's in many ways left out. First off, he condenses, and I think I'm right on this, and obviously this should be checked, but he condenses two brothers into one character. So Eli in the movie, who's a character in the book, has an older brother named Paul, and he has the same actor, I believe, play them. Paul's the guy who originally comes and tells them that there's oil on their land, and then Eli is the kind of wacky minister who's, you know, is you know, the person who's trying to instill his own version of Christianity in people. So he condenses those two people. Paul in the novel is actually a really important character because the novel follows him out. Paul actually becomes a communist by the end of the novel and gets killed during a political event. And what Sinclair tried to do was to take the son in the novel, whose name is Bunny, who only makes it to the movie has him becoming deaf because of the explosion. That doesn't happen in the novel. Bunny, the character, actually lives a long life, and it's in fact, Bunny becomes kind of opposed to both his father's greediness and selfishness. He becomes a socialist, but he also rejects Paul's revolutionary communism, which is a message that Sinclair was really eager to get across, that socialism is not the same thing as, say, Bolshevik communism. And so he uses these characters and plays them out so that by the end of it, they're in conflict with one another as much as Bunny's in conflict with his father, which is obviously, I think, a theme that the movie somewhat has, but it doesn't allow for the kind of adult Bunny to kind of really develop. So that's one crucial difference. And I think in some ways, you know, my sense of the movie is that it leaves you with this sort of, like you pointed out, the conflict between, you know, American religion and the greed that the father, you know, has embarked upon, total greed, in fact, to just kind of, you know, give his son away in the end, or throughout the movie. I think that, like, what's not there, I mean, Sinclair thinks that religion is a boondoggle. He thinks that he has a kind of Marxist idea of religion, that is, that religion is a way to is the kind of opiate of the masses. It keeps people obsessed with their standing in the God's eyes and whether or not they're going to go to heaven, to the expense of them paying attention to their actual living conditions on this earth here and now. So it diverts people from becoming like he is, a revolutionary socialist. So, you know, he's got that critique of religion, and that critique of religion plays itself through in the novel. This is a period of time in which there's a famous religious figure, Amy Semple McPherson, who's a big religious figure during the 1920s, an evangelical and a Pentecostal, essentially. And she's got this huge, big church in Los Angeles, very garish and stuff like that, and has all sorts of scandals during her life. And Sinclair is trying to critique that type of religion and how it diverts people from paying attention to the real conditions in the world. And you know, so that's there in the novel. But I think the movie just kind of, you know, takes it as the father's anger at Eli and his frustration with Eli, and that sort of that horrific final scene in the novel where he just beats Eli to death with a bowling pin. That sort of message is not really in the novel. There's a much more complex development of religion's role in you know, throughout the course of the novel. And I think that the movie in some ways just kind of takes that and just kind of truncates it the way it does with a lot of the other developments that the novel tells.
As you were saying, it is hard to do a full adaptation in that way in terms of a lot of the themes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm not saying that in necessarily a critical way. My only concern sometimes when I watch movies is I think, if this is going to be the way that if someone walks out of the theater, or more likely, you know, after watching it, at their home, and thinks, oh, this is what Upton Sinclair wanted us to get out of, you know, writing a book like this, that's what makes me a little bit worried, because obviously I think a lot of people will sometimes, as I did for, you know, I read the book, but I thought I could, you know, refresh my memory about what the book was about. But if people, well, it's film in many ways, and they think that that's the book that's based upon really the book that Upton Sinclair wrote, that's the only part that makes me feel a little bit, you know, uncomfortable. And I think there is, you know, the book has a lot more ambition, I think, packed into it than is necessarily carried out through the movie, which is not to criticize the movie. It's just to point out that, you know, the book itself, it has some very different themes and issues that it tries to develop.
And I was going to ask on that, in terms of adaptations of Upton Sinclair's work, is there anyone that's done a good job of it? And if so, what's worth seeking out?
No, it's, you know, this is another funny thing about Upton Sinclair. Upton Sinclair hungered to become, you know, a producer of movies. Throughout his life, he always wanted to break into movies. And the reason he did, I think, is the reason that people go to see movies today. He thought that he could reach more people through movies than he could through the writing of a novel. And, you know, on that count, I think he's right. So there is actually an original version of The Jungle that gets made fairly close to the time that the book is made, and obviously it's a silent movie. Unfortunately, there's no copies of the movie that still exist. Nobody has been able to track down a copy. They've all kind of turned to dust. But that, you know, the fact that a movie is made upon The Jungle, and that Upton Sinclair is eager to see this happen, gives you a sense that I think Upton Sinclair always thought of himself as something of a cinematic writer himself. There are numerous occasions where he actually, in fact, tries to work with Sergei Eisenstein when he comes to the United States briefly, tries to help him make a movie. Upton Sinclair writes numerous scripts for Charlie Chaplin, who was a kind of friend of Sinclair's, not close friend, but, you know, an acquaintance, you could say. So, and Sinclair constantly peppers him with, like, movie scripts, none of which does Charlie Chaplin make, because Chaplin had to control everything from, you know, the script on to the actual final production. So, but he's trying to do that. His final success at this is that there's a movie called The Gnomemobile, which is a Walt Disney movie that comes out towards the end of his life, which is this kind of child's book that Sinclair writes that has to do with these gnomes in a forest who get threatened by people trying to, you know, log the forest, and it's this sort of proto-environmental sort of kids book. That gets made by Disney into a movie. And the reason I raise those is that, you know, Sinclair actually really wanted his books to be made into movies. So I think in some ways, you know, even though obviously this is a case where the movie is made long after he's passed away, I think in some ways he would have actually been happy with the movie. I think he would have been disappointed that the socialist message that the book clearly carries was dropped out, because that's what he wanted people to come to. But on the other hand, I think he would be really, really excited to see, you know, the beautiful imagery that film has, you know, those shots of him out on the oil fields and the I know it's mostly filmed, I think, in West Texas, you know, those areas where he's first exploring, and the way he uses a kind of slow sort of, you know, kind of slow approach to telling the story. I think all those things would have been things that Upton Sinclair would have been really excited. I just think that in the end, he would have been profoundly disappointed that people didn't walk out of the movie and want to join the Socialist Party.
As for Upton Sinclair, what do you see as his value today in modern America?
Well, I think he was one of these people who understood that if America, I mean, first off, you know, I think he is someone who had a deep affinity for the American dream in many ways, in surprising ways. I mean, he really believed in America and he believed in the possibility of America. And I think, though, what he believed was that Americans had to take, they had to really examine some of the pitfalls of their society. They had to deal with questions of poverty, with questions of inequality, with, you know, the kind of laboring conditions that industrialization brought with it, and the kind of harshness of laboring conditions, which he, I think, did pretty well in telling the stories about the meatpacking plants. I think he thought that Americans had to pay closer attention to the deficiencies in their society in order to become a better society. And I think he saw his role as a novelist to constantly come back to that theme, to write novels that in some ways were expose. So the jungle being an expose of the meatpacking plants, oil being an expose of the greed behind this sort of wildcat oil drilling that's going on during the 1920s. He always wanted to, you know, kind of force Americans to think about some of the pitfalls of their society, and yet try to do that in a way that I think was trying to reach as many people as he possibly could through the use of telling, you know, stories that were entertaining to get that message across. I think that's probably Sinclair's most lasting legacy, and I think we can recognize that lasting legacy is important, but at the same time see some of the weaknesses. That is that he wasn't always the best writer. He sometimes rushed a lot of things. He sometimes, I think, was a poor political judge. But even considering all that stuff, I think we come back to this notion that he thought America would be a better country if it paid attention to some of its problems. And that's, I think, kind of central to his life, which was a long-lived life.
People often put him in the vein of investigative journalists and mm-hmm. say that he's sort of the godfather or grandfather of modern investigative journalism. Do you see that to be the case or no?
I think what he's very good at is that a lot of people will say that there's this broad movement in literary circles known as realism. Sometimes it's called naturalism, that you start to see in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. That's like novelists like Stephen Crane, Red Badge of Courage, Theodore Dreiser, Sister Carrie, Frank Norris's novels. There's this move towards telling stories that are realistic, meaning that you have the author has a responsibility to describe the world he's trying to write about. Sinclair kind of works out of that tradition. He actually starts as a romanticist novelist. Many of the novels he wrote before this were very romantic, very kind of like a young artist who can't be understood, and so he kind of commits suicide, and very sentimental, romantic sort of writing. He kind of comes to realism, and the first novel there where I think he does the best job at it is The Jungle. And he thinks that if he's going to write about, the meatpacking plant and try to raise Americans' consciousness about the exploitation of the workers within the plants, that he's actually got to see the plants for himself. So one of the things that he does is he goes to Chicago, he networks with a bunch of social workers and some labor organizers, and they tell him, well, you know, if you want to go inside the meatpacking plants, you should do it, but you shouldn't go in looking like you're investigating. So what he does is he kind of puts a little cap on, brings a little lunch pail, and pretends he's a worker. Goes into the meatpacking plants, makes observations, never writes anything down because he knows that'll get him booted, then goes back to his hotel and writes everything down, and then tries to incorporate those observations into the story of The Jungle. So I think he is, I mean, if you want to call that investigative journalism, yeah, but on the other hand, he still writes a novel. So he's not writing, magazine exposés about the meatpacking trust. He's writing a novel, although it's based upon his own investigative observation. I think what makes him unique is that makes The Jungle unique is that it combines the sort of literary ambition with a kind of journalistic element to it. In some ways, I think of it as, you know, a novel that has a long impact, in part because I think, you know, some people would take it to be the exemplar of like the great American novel. It's realistic, but it's also got this sort of, you know, literary ambition to it. I wouldn't say that he's an investigative journalist, because that's, I think, that there are plenty of people in his own day and age who are doing more journalistic writing than he is. But I think he incorporates objective investigative reporting into writing a novel, essentially.
As for yourself, what's the latest things you're working on? Any new books?
I'm working on something that's going to be a long time in the making, and it's kind of funny that it's the case that it'll be a long time in the making. I'm writing kind of a cultural and intellectual history of punk rock from 1969 up to the late 1980s. And it's the reason it's going to take a lot of time is because there's a whole slew of publications, many of which are kind of hard to find, that I have to get my hands on to write this. So I'm doing that, working on some other smaller projects and stuff like that. I've actually considered about writing about some of the people that Sinclair was involved in with back in the Greenwich Village Bohemian days prior to World War I, who wind up moving out to New Mexico and trying to find a sort of alternative to American business life in the New Mexico setting. But that's a long time in the making. These are just kind of ideas that I'm, you know, bouncing around.
And if people want to learn more about your work or pick up your books, where's the best place to do that?
They can, if you just Google my name, my website will come up as the first entry. It's a website that's hosted through my university, Ohio University. They can find out my publications from that. They can go to also any of the other places they want to go to, the Amazons, of the world, or whatever place they, like to buy their books from.
Thank you to Kevin Mattson. He's the author of Upton Sinclair and the Other American Century, and is the professor of contemporary history at Ohio University. You can learn more about his work and his book over at our website, projection-boot.com.
Now, we talked a bit about the plot in both places and some of the main characters. So I thought maybe we could get into these characters. So let's just start with Daniel Day-Lewis as Daniel Plainview. When we first meet him, it's actually really interesting because as we talked to already, there's a good almost 20 minutes where we really don't hear his voice. We hear him whisper just one thing when he finds the silver deposit. That's it. That's all he says. And when we first meet him, he's in like total darkness. We can't even really make out his face. He's just this man digging in the dirt. And what do we kind of get as we move along with the Plainview character? How do we see him?
The first thing we learn about him is his determination when he falls into that hole and then has to crawl his way back to wherever they're counting out that silver. And we don't see him making his way across the desert on his elbows and knee, but that's what I picture, and just kind of learn from that nothing is going to stand in his way.
And that he actually is putting his success, you know, ahead of his, ahead of everything else. I mean, this is very much this idea of the self-made man. He's not only ambitious, but everything he has to do, above all things, he has to succeed by himself if necessary. And I think it's very important that what's interesting about the film is while the movie's wordless for that first 14 minutes, after that, he either speaks a lot or not at all. And that's because everything he says is in service to his own success. So he's not a man of few words. He's a man of only necessary words. He can talk as much as he needs to get something from someone. But other than that, he doesn't seem to have much reason to talk to people because, frankly, he doesn't like them. He goes on to say very much so that he can't there's nothing worth liking in the people that he sees. And he even confesses later to Henry, and I know we'll talk about that later, is that he can't do this on his own with these people, as if all of humanity is something that he can't engage with.
There really is this sort of sense of the other, that he's not part of society, that he has separated himself, or maybe there's just, you know, there's some sort of like sociopathic element in him that will allow him to use things like the kid, because the kid's not his. You know, he plays off as he's this family man, and I run a family business, and all of this stuff. But the boy is not his. The boy was something that he stumbled upon in working in the field. The father is killed, and he picks up the boy and takes him with him. And when we see that, it's now 9 years later or 10 years later, and he's saying, here's my son, and this is our business, and using that as a way to get to people. We also see that throughout the film, he has no problem, well, sometimes he has a problem, with conforming himself to what other people want of him in order for him to get, ultimately, as you said, in service of what his ultimate goal is.
Yeah, but and yet there's a, you know, it's funny because there are two ways, I think, of approaching his character. One is seeing him in more symbolic terms, in terms of, you know, the American dream and the self-made man, and that he doesn't need anybody else. And also in terms of, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson's rising misanthropy, which seems to be in this film and The Master. On the other hand, you could look at the movie, even though the movie goes out of its way to hide emotionalism from you, you could look at this character as a very lonely man, and he's using the few tools that he has to try and construct a family for himself, which is a theme that you see constantly in Anderson's work, whether it's Boogie Nights, where, you know, people in the porn industry form their own ramshackle family, to here, where I think Plainview in some ways is doing the same thing. And I think either take is a fair assessment of the character. You know, whether you're feeling generous and want to see this as a character piece, as a character who, a very, very flawed man, but a very, very ambitious man trying to create his own family, kind of almost the self-made taken to its furthest extreme. Not only is he going to make his own success, he's going to redefine what a family is, which I think is an interesting way of looking at it.
He self-creates a family, and then he comes upon the Sunday family. And he's tipped off by Paul Dano, who plays twins, although we only see Paul Sunday in this one scene, where he comes to ask Daniel basically, how much is land worth if you have oil? And then says, my family's land has oil. So he has this ruse where he goes, oh, we're going to go hunting, like him and the boy, and then, oh, well, we just happen to be here, and then stumble upon the Sunday family and meets them, who is Abel, the father, and then this is where we meet Eli for the first time, who is this charismatic Christian, sort of Pentecostalist minister, well, in training, like he wants to be that. And so we have the one family that he's created with the boy, and then they happen upon the Sunday family. And it's kind of interesting what happens once he gets into that space and starts working with them on pulling the oil out of the ground.
And I also think right off the bat, it's what's interesting is even though Paul has a very small role in this film, you know, the twin brother to Eli, he acts as a pretty interesting counterpoint. You know, if you look at both capitalism and religion as seen as two machines by which men can be corrupt and manipulative and grandiose in their kind of sense of self realization. I think there are other characters that kind of balance that. They're all minor characters, and Paul is one of them. While Eli, in many ways, is very similar to Daniel, and I think that's the thing that each man recognizes in one another, that they understand how they use language, how they manipulate people, all those things. They use things in very similar ways but different, you know, one using religion and one using business. But then you have Paul, who is probably every bit the capitalist that, you know, most Americans would be, but not particularly ambitious. He's content to cash out. And I think there's even a reference towards the end of the film where they indicate that he's, you know, lived very happily without greater aspirations. And you see similar aspirations, and I guess we're kind of jumping ahead, but with Plainview's son, with H.W. and the woman he eventually marries, who's very clearly still in the faith. And there's kind of a more humble acceptance of religion with their characters, even though with Eli, it's a very perverse form of religion. So you have these minor characters having the kind of the same attributes of religion and capitalism in, you know, as, I don't know, small compact mirrors to Plainview and Eli.
Yeah, the one thing that was missing from the movie that really made an impact on me with the book was the whole idea that, you know, we're talking about the Plainview character really just being this master manipulator. He's the one that actually kind of starts the Church of the Third Revelation by using that as his way to kind of get in with the family a little bit more. And also, you know, there's an issue in the movie that they bring up that the daughter, I believe it's Mary in the movie and it's Ruth in the book, that her father is beating her. And so the Plainview character goes to the family and he's going to tell them that he had a revelation and that, you know, they shouldn't, you know, fathers should not beat their children kind of thing. And all of a sudden they start going into their whole speaking in tongues and convulsing and all this stuff. And there's this whole thing where Eli learns that Paul has been in contact with the Plainview character and with the HW character. And he gets so mad that he thinks that he should be the one who has had this revelation and basically turns everything on its ear and claims that he had this revelation and becomes this, you know, very, very popular preacher and goes out into the world and just kind of, you know, is spreading the gospel. And it's funny because the way that Bunny puts it in the book is that he was given this very limited set of language by his father, but that's all that Eli needs to go out and preach the word, because he has a very limited understanding. He has a very limited base of knowledge, but really the people in the religious community don't need much more than that.
There's a scene in the film that sort of mirrors the one that you're talking about from the book, where Plainview is, they're having like a picnic out by the derrick. And he's on one side of the table, and Abel Sunday, the father, is on the other side of the table. And Mary comes over, and we get sort of a few scenes between Daniel and Mary, the little girl. And we get the idea that, you know, maybe there's a little connection there, that he's kind of looking after her like a daughter in some way, and that now that he's come to town and he's doing all this drilling and everything, he's almost coming in and usurping the power of the father in the Sunday family.
Would you like your new dress?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. Don't you like it? Are you happy I came here?
Yes.
Your daddy doesn't hit you anymore, does he? Does he now? Better not, right? I'll take care of you. No more hitting, right? No more hitting. Go and play some more. Don't come back.
And then we get this, I think, rack focus or this sort of look over to Abel, and he's just like burning his eyes basically through Daniel Plainview, sort of like, who are you to tell me how to run my family? And so that scene is in there. It's just, it's played a little bit differently than how you explain it. And it's much more menacing. We get the idea that this is sort of like him giving him a warning.
That kind of brings up two things for me. One of them is, one of the scenes that's not in the book that is very interesting in the movie is when Eli crawls across the table and chokes his father, and this whole idea of him being smarter than his dad and, you know, why did you take this offer and you could have gotten so much more money and all this kind of thing. This whole idea, you know, the whole movie to me is so much of a struggle between sons and their fathers and vice versa. And it also brings to mind the way that he, Plainview, was talking to Ruth/Mary in the movie, just talking to her, but yet really talking to Abel. Kind of reminds me of that later scene, and I know I'm jumping ahead, but the later scene where he is –
hear the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.